This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
Lies, expulsions, bigotry, witch hunts. This isn't the story of a battle-torn country, but of a civil war within a sport, as rugby became a symbol of class division and split in two.
Sport and the British. Rugby's great split.
I'm here at the home of the Wigan Warriors, and this is the modern face of a club steeped in tradition. We're in the heartland of rugby league, and Wigan is the most successful and the most famous club of the lot. Now, arguments may rage as to which is the better sport, rugby union or rugby league, but the biggest question of all is why on earth are there two rugbies? It happened in the late 19th century, a clash between those who could afford to be gentlemen amateurs and those who couldn't. This story goes to the heart of how important class was and is in Britain. It illustrates that sport is just as capable of dividing people as uniting them. It also shows that sport isn't just a leisure activity. It's about who you play with and how you play. And rugby is the clearest example of how important sport became to the way people see themselves and their place in society. And that's why the split was so bitter, because it wasn't just about sport. So how did it all begin? Well, in 1871, the Rugby Football Union, or RFU, was formed. Rugby took off, and it proved particularly popular, both in terms of playing and watching, with the working class. In 1874, the Half-Day Holiday Act meant that the six-day working week was reduced to 5.5 days. That left Saturday afternoons free for entertainment, and they had the money to pay for it. Professor Tony Collins of De Montfort University.
The working classes poured into rugby in the 1870s. Either as spectators in huge numbers, tens of thousands went to games, or as players, where they eventually came to dominate the game. But the other thing they brought was a different cultural tradition. Working class players saw sport as a form of entertainment. They would get paid if they were good enough, they would win prizes if they were successful. But middle class players had been brought up in the philosophy of the public schools of Arnold and Tom Brown's school days. For them, sport was about moral education, about building character. And these two traditions, these two cultures, ultimately came to clash, both on and off the field.
With the mass popularity of rugby came rugby receipts. In the 1870s, the game was making money hand over fist, but the players, in theory, weren't allowed to benefit. But payments in kind were frequent, and they were inventive. A leg of mutton here, a watch there, material for a suit, bottles of port. And borrowing a trick from cricket, Wakefield Trinity signed a star three quarterback, Teddy Bartram, and paid him £1 a week to be the club's secretary. His secretarial skills doubtless extended no further than lacing his own boots. Poaching became common practice in northern clubs, who would offer inducements for good players. And standing here in front of the North Stand, it was here in the North that rugby really bloomed. In the first 7 years of rugby's county championship, it was won 6 times by Yorkshire and once by Lancashire. The North and the working class teams were dominant, but there was a marked difference of attitude on the field. For the southern gentleman amateur brought up with public school ethics, sport was about self-control. One should be restrained in victory and gracious in defeat. So what was this cheering, chanting and celebratory behaviour? And what was this rewards business?
There was a great fear amongst the leaders of the rugby union that the game was being taken over by the working classes. They felt that working classes were too competitive, they were too rough. They also didn't like spectators. They didn't like playing a game where they, as they often said, where we could be hooted and jeered at by the unwashed masses who were watching on the terraces. So it led to a huge amount of tension.
In October 1886, at the general meeting of the Rugby Football Union, the RFU, the sport was confirmed as an amateur game. No payment would be received for playing, although travel costs and other expenses could be met. The future president, Arthur Budd, argued that they had to throttle the Hydra. But this didn't stop Northern Rugby. Between October 1888 and 1890, six of the leading clubs were suspended for offering money or jobs to players. 10 players were put on trial by Yorkshire's committee for violating the code. 6 of them were suspended. Harry Bradshaw for getting an unauthorised wedding present from his club. And then came the witch hunts. Dickie Lockwood was one of the star players of the day. He'd made his first-class debut at the age of 16, got his first England cap at 19, captained his country to victory against Wales, and captained Yorkshire to 3 successive county championships. But Lockwood worked in a textile factory for 9 shillings a week. He couldn't afford to miss work to play rugby for nothing.
There was a widespread suspicion in Yorkshire rugby and in rugby nationally that Dickie Lockwood was being paid to play. And the rumours grew so loud that eventually the Yorkshire Rugby Union called Lockwood to appear before them and put him on trial for professionalism. And you have to remember at this time that if you were found guilty of accepting money to play the game, you could be suspended or more likely banished from the game for life. So in many ways, Dickie Lockwood was put on trial for his sporting life.
And this from the actual trial transcript.
Do you know Mr. Crabtree of Morley?
Yes.
What did he offer you?
He did not offer to apprentice me to him. I was not paid anything. If anyone stated I was paid, it would be wrong.
A gentleman stated you were paid 10 shillings a week.
Well, that gentleman is wrong.
I want you to be very particular about this. I have positive information that you were paid after refusing to go to Morley.
I was not, sir.
It was almost like a police interrogation. The detail that Marshall wanted to know and the extent to which he had done his research. However, Dickie Lockwood had learnt from the trials of previous players who had been accused of professionalism and simply denied any accusation as professionalism. He denied he'd ever received money, denied he'd ever been offered any jobs. And without his confession, there could be no conviction. And this happened twice to Dickie Lockwood. Twice he was put on trial. Twice he was found not guilty because there was no evidence that he had been paid, despite the widespread rumours and the fact that it's almost certain that he was paid to play the game.
A solution to the problem of missing work to play rugby came with the suggestion of broken time, the reimbursement by the rugby clubs of wages lost when a working man took time off to play. The 1890s were a volatile period. There had been strikes by mill workers, gas men, miners and dockers protesting about poor working conditions. Troops had been called out to keep the peace. And in West Yorkshire, 2 men had died and 12 were wounded in the skirmishes. For the working classes to now demand rights on the rugby field was beyond the pale for some. And so, famously, 22 northern clubs met at the George Hotel Huddersfield on a rainy night on the 29th of August 1895. The hotel was close to the station and equidistant between Hull in the east and Widnes in the west. At this meeting, they decided to form their own Northern Rugby Football Union, what came to be known as Rugby League. Broken time payment was confirmed and set at 6 shillings a day. With the exception of Dewsbury, the clubs resigned from the RFU, who in retaliation introduced new anti-professionalism laws. In one sense, there was joy, a feeling of liberation and excitement at the brave new world, as one anonymous letter to the Yorkshire Post proclaimed.
I say, with Mark Twain's Bold Bad Boy, that we glory in the sentence of outlawry pronounced on us, as freeing us from the tyrannical bondage of the English Union, and we breathe pure air in being freed from the stifling atmosphere of deceit in which we previously existed.
But in another sense, there was fear. The division was brutal. Anyone who was in any way connected with the Northern Union was banned for life by the RFU. There was no compromise. This was war.
As soon as the Northern clubs had split, the Rugby Football Union said that anybody who plays for a Northern Union club or is associated anyway as an official or a referee is banned for life from any participation in the rugby union. Not just playing rugby union, but they're even banned from entering clubhouses, which had never took place in any other sport. For rugby union, rugby league became the other, which was to be rejected, was to be exercised, which was to be defined as the opponent. For rugby league,
rugby union became the symbol of the establishment, how the north of England wasn't being given a fair go in society, the way in which working class people were discriminated against. It was all seen through the prism of rugby union's ban on rugby league players. And this lasted until the 1970s, 1980s. So there was an absolute iron curtain erected between the two codes by the rugby union.
The fallout was extreme, and I'll just tell you a couple of stories to illustrate it. In 1928, a player from County Durham called Armstrong signed for league, but he changed his mind on the way home, so he returned the contract and the cheque to the club. He then wrote to the RFU to say, look, I've made a mistake. But when they got his letter, the RFU banned him from the game for life. Another player called Tom Brown met with rugby league officials in 1933 but decided to stay with his club, Bristol. For the meeting, the rugby league had paid his travel expenses. He was banned for life from rugby union, despite the fact he'd never even seen a game of league, let alone played it. In fact, he didn't see one until he bought a TV set in 1954. It took until 1995, almost 100 years to the day that rugby in the UK had split over payment to players, for rugby union to turn professional. The pressure had come from South Africa, from New Zealand and from Australia, and the England captain, Will Carling, had described the RFU as being run by 57 old farts. Finally, it came into the modern world. Gareth Edwards, who spent his life as an amateur player, has been described as arguably the greatest player ever to don a Welsh jersey.
Everybody that was involved with the local rugby club did it out of love for the game. The players played an amateur game, but also, just as important, the committee men, the people who cleaned the clubs, who whitewashed the pitch, the groundsmen, and it was their three penneth worth into looking after the locality, so to speak. When the game changed professionally, people's attitude changed with it. They said, oh, well, if the players are going to be paid, we want to be paid for looking after the pitch. And before you know it, there was a huge fallout.
In the corridor of the DW Stadium, outside the director's box and the chairman's box, is the glass-fronted trophy cabinet. And in here are two enormous trophies at the front. I mean, both of them sort of 2.5, 3 feet tall, and various cups and bowls and mugs signifying victory in one competition or another. And you wonder, looking at this, whether rugby lost its strength, lost its power when the division splintered it, whether maybe rugby, rather than football, could have become the national sport. Maybe rugby and not football could have spread around the world. And you also wonder whether there will ever be a day when rugby as a whole realises its full potential, whether the league and the union could ever come back together, because the last 100 years in this sport has been full of history, but poisoned by hostility.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.